morning, everyone. Is that good enough? Can you hear me well? Okay. All right. This morning, for those of you that attend North Little Rock and sit in my Opus Israel class on Sundays, this is going to be a kind of a refresher, a review. But to me, it's such a beautiful subject. I think I wanted to make sure we present it here at the Bible school gathering this weekend. Let's turn our Bibles open to Galatians 4, and we're going to read what Paul presents to us regarding events which occurred in the life of Abraham, Sarah, Ishmael, and Isaac. So we'll start our reading in Galatians 4, verse 21. Tell me, ye that desire to be under the law, do you not hear the law? For it is written that Abraham had two sons, the one by a bondmaid and the other by a free woman. But he who was of the bondwoman was born after the flesh, but he of the free woman was by promise. Which things are an allegory? For these are the two covenants, the one from the Mount Sinai, which gendereth to bondage, which is Hagar. For this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia, and answereth to Jerusalem, which now is, and is in bondage with her children. But Jerusalem, which is above, is free, which is the mother of us all. For it is written, Rejoice, thou barren that bearest not, break forth and cry, thou that travailest not. For the desolate hath more than she which hath an husband. Now we, brethren, as Isaac was, are the children of promise. But as then he that was born after the flesh persecuted him that was born after the Spirit, even so it is now. Nevertheless, what saith the Scripture? Cast out the bondwoman and her son, for the son of the bondwoman shall not be heir with the son of the free woman. So then, brethren, we are not children of the bondwoman, but of the free. Now, as we started this reading, initially, Paul brings our attention to a great lesson regarding Yahweh's plan and the promised seed. At our first glance, a simple summary of this reading would conclude that Paul was correcting the Judaizers of his day regarding their desire to uphold the law of Moses. Remember what we read there in verse 21. Tell me, ye that desire to be under the law, do you not hear the law? But upon further examination of this entire, all his words, we find many other great lessons. First of all, we see how he discusses Yahweh's covenants of promise. He also details the promised seed, both in its singular aspect as well in its multitudinous aspect. And of course, he alludes to particulars of Yahweh's kingdom and the inheritance of the righteous. Paul relays to us the historical life of Abraham, Sarah, Hagar, and Ishmael before the brethren of Galatia. He terms what some may call a story as really an allegory. When we read verse 24 or 21 through 24, he says, For it is written that Abraham had two sons, the one by a bondmaid, the other by a free woman. But he who was of the bondwoman was born after the flesh, but he of the free woman was by promise. Which things are an allegory? Now first we have to understand what this word allegory means. If you were just to look it up in a dictionary, you may find this description. Basically, a representation of an abstract or a spiritual meaning through concrete or material forms, or maybe even a symbolical narrative. But actually, as well, this is from two Greek words. First Greek word is allos, which means other, and agerio, which means to speak to an assembly. That is, that it is something representative, different from that which is spoken about, something in order to illustrate principles. So when we read Galatians 22 through 4, 22 through 31, what the apostle is doing is he's proving how the Old Testament types or their symbols or allegories provides important insight to or helps us to correctly understand and interpret the Scriptures. Paul even alluded to this when he said, God, who at sundry times and in divers manners spake in times past unto the fathers by the prophets. From Hebrews 1, verse 1. So we know that then Paul and those that wrote in the New Testament, their duty was to help us understand the things written in the Old, the things that were delivered under the law, or the things that were delivered to us by the prophets. So then, brethren, it is our duty to read what the prophets have written in order to help us understand better these lessons. So let's now turn back to Genesis chapter 21. Genesis 21, and we'll start at verse 1. It says, and the Lord, or Yahweh, visited Sarah, as he had said, and Yahweh did unto Sarah as he had spoken. For Sarah conceived, and bare Abraham a son in his old age, at the set time of which God had spoken to him. And Abraham called the name of his son that was born unto him, whom Sarah bare to him, Isaac. And Abraham circumcised his son Isaac, being 8 days old, as God had commanded him. And Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born unto him. And Sarah said, God hath made me to laugh, so that all that hear will laugh with me. And she said, who would have said unto Abraham that Sarah should have given children suck? For I have borne him a son in his old age. And the child grew and was weaned. And Abraham made a great feast the same day that Isaac was weaned. And Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, which she had borne unto Abraham, mocking. Wherefore she said to Abraham, cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, even with Isaac. And the thing was very grievous in Abraham's sight, because of his son. And God said to Abraham, let it not be grievous in thy sight because of the lad, and because of thy bondwoman. And all that Sarah hath said unto thee, hearken unto her voice. For in Isaac shall thy seed be called. And also of the son of the bondwoman will I make a nation, because he is thy seed. And Abraham rose up early in the morning, took bread and a bottle of water, and gave it to Hagar, putting it on her shoulder, and the child, and sent her away, and she departed, and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba. And the water was spent in the bottle, and she cast the child under one of the shrubs. And she went and sat her down over against him a good way off, as it were a bowshot. For she said, let me not see the death of the child. And she sat over against him, and lift up her voice, and wept. And God heard the voice of the lad, and the angel of God called to Hagar out of heaven and said unto her, what aileth thee, Hagar? Fear not, for God hath heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad, and hold him in thine hand, for I'll make him a great nation. And God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. And she went and filled the bottle with water and gave the lad drink. And God was with the lad, and he grew and dwelt in the wilderness, and became an archer. And he dwelt in the wilderness of Paran. And his mother took him a wife out of the land of Egypt. So now that we've read both the actual account and then Paul's interpretation thereof, we'd like to then go through all the points which we have seen. The summary of the situation we find that Abraham then had two sons, Ishmael, the son of Hagar, an Egyptian handmaid. and Isaac, who was the son of Sarah. Now we know, if we were have read through other scriptures, that Ishmael was 14 years old when Isaac was born. And we know that when Ishmael was born, it was probably or possibly due to the lack of faith which was exhibited in Sarah and maybe even Abraham. And therefore, it is said that he was then born after the flesh. Now, whereas Isaac, we know, was born due to providential circumstances, considering that, you know, Sarah was 90 and Abraham at this time was 100 years old at the time of Isaac's birth. She was capable of enduring such a great event at this age because she was strengthened by Yahweh. And of course, this was according to the promise that Yahweh had given. Therefore, we can adequately say, and the scriptures bear this forth in Galatians 4:29, that Isaac's birth was a birth which was born after the Spirit, not after the flesh. So when we think about Hagar, now she was a bondwoman. She was subservient then to Sarah. She is a servant to both Sarah and the house of Abraham. But of course, Sarah was a free woman. Turn to Genesis 17 and 18. Genesis chapter 17, verse 18. And in this chapter, we see both the names of Abraham and Sarah were changed. Abraham changed from Abram. You know, Abram, which first meant exalted father, now his name is changed to father of many nations. Sarah, or Sarai, as she was first named, was my princess, now becomes just princess. But in verse 18 we read, "And Abraham said unto God, Oh, that Ishmael might live before thee." You know, here we see that God was reiterating the promises of this promised seed and had told them regarding Sarah still to bear a child. And Abraham desired that Ishmael would still be part of this promised seed. From this it is apparent that if it had been left unto Abraham, he would have made Ishmael his heir as well as Isaac. For later we see that it grieved Abraham out of the house. Remember back in Genesis 21:11. For Abraham loved both Ishmael and Isaac. But we know as time grew and after the birth of Isaac, that Ishmael exhibited a spirit much like his mother, a spirit which he most likely learned from his mother. Moses says that Ishmael mocked Isaac, or that he had spoken contemptuously of him. Paul in Galatians 4:29 compares this and says that Ishmael persecuted him. And you think about, you know, well, why was Ishmael this way? Remember what happened immediately after the birth of Ishmael. Remember the attitude that Hagar exhibited before Sarai. You know, presuming that she now had the promised seed in her own thoughts, she thought that then she should be elevated in the house of Abraham. And of course, Sarai knew exactly that that was not the case, and, you know, reprimanded her for such. But of course, you can think, you know, Hagar, remember, she was an Egyptian. Egyptian, or Egypt, is a symbol of darkness. So it's very apparent that she did not have a good understanding of Yahweh's truth. Now, once Ishmael persecuted or mocked Isaac after his weaning, We see again Sarah's indignation being excited. If you look at Genesis 21, verse 10, you see how upset she was at this circumstance. It says, "Wherefore she said unto Abraham, cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, even with Isaac." Now, although Abraham was exceedingly grieved at this, God approved of Sarah's decision and informed him that Christ, that this seed or this Christ, should descend from Isaac and not from Ishmael. He said, "In Isaac shall thy seed be called." But because Ishmael was the son of Abraham, we were told that he would give him or make him a great nation, with also 12 princes coming from him. Let's go back to chapter 17 and reread verses 18 through 21, because that does reiterate the promises that were given regarding Ishmael. In Genesis 17, we read verse 18, "And Abraham said to God, Oh, that Ishmael might live before thee. And God said, No, Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac. I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant, and with his descendants or his seed after him. As for Ishmael, I have heard you. Behold, I have blessed him, and will make him fruitful, and will multiply him exceedingly. He shall beget 12 princes, and I will make him a great nation. But my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah shall bear to thee at this set time next year." So this portion of Abraham's history has a significance beyond what is apparent sometimes at face value. So therefore, the Apostle Paul felt it necessary to explain it to us. He tells us back in Galatians 4 that the incidents are allegorical. And he tells us that these two women and the characteristics that these two women displayed represented two covenants. And also, the two sons of Abraham that were born to him, they also represent two seeds, or you may say, two classes of persons. So you can see here, we have Hagar, a bondwoman. She represented that covenant of Sinai, basically the law of Moses that was delivered, institution delivered in Sinai. And she bore unto Abraham Ishmael. Sarah, being the free woman, she represents to us the covenants of promise, the everlasting covenant delivered to Abraham, referring to that promised seed, which would be Isaac, as we will see later, Christ, and even the multitudinous Christ. The covenants are the one from Mount Sinai in Arabia, as we're told in Galatians 4, which is the law of Moses, and the other was termed the Abrahamic covenant, a covenant which God confirmed 430 years before the law of Moses was ever declared to the Israelites. This was a covenant of promise. This covenant of promise would bear forth the details of a promised seed, this seed being Christ, as defined by Paul in Galatians, and which was called Jerusalem above. So when we go back in Galatians chapter 4, you'll see that Hagar was representative of Jerusalem, which now is, but Sarah was considered representing that covenant of promise, which was from Jerusalem above, or which is above. The apostle says that Jerusalem is the subject of both of these covenants, but it's regarding Jerusalem in two different periods of her history. First, during her existence as the metropolis of the Hebrew Commonwealth under its constitution, which was delivered in Sinai, she was then represented by Hagar, the bondwoman, because the covenant from Sinai gendered bondage. In consequence, the citizens of the Commonwealth were in bondage with that mother city. Let's go to Galatians 5, where he also talks about this aspect of the bondage. Galatians 5, verses 1 through 3. Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty by which Christ has made us free, and do not be entangled again with a yoke of bondage. Indeed, I, Paul, say to you that if you become circumcised, Christ will profit you nothing. And I testify again to every man who becomes circumcised that he is a debtor to keep the entire or the whole law. So here we see that Paul is exhorting the brethren not to be entangled again with the yoke of bondage, and that every man that is circumcised, he was reminding them, if they were to be circumcised, then they were to be a debtor to do the whole law. This verse in Galatians details to us how the Israelites were kept in bondage. They were bound to keep the whole law by which they sought to be justified. And as each person could not keep it in its entirety, owning to the weakness of the flesh, therefore each individual came under its curse. Look at Galatians 3, verse 10. Galatians 3:10 tells us, "For as many as are of the works of the law are under the curse. For it is written, cursed is everyone who does not continue in all things which are written in the book of the law to do them." So therefore, brethren, we see that they were in bondage to this law. They were in bondage to do all the things which were written there under, but yet they couldn't follow it. Therefore, they were even cursed by it. Now, this state of bondage that we know was a temporary thing, or it was provisional, as you might say. God did not intend for the Hebrew Commonwealth to exist perpetually under this constitution which was delivered to them in Sinai. Israel was not always to be in bondage to this law of Moses. A great revolution was predetermined of God, which should result in the abolishment and the dispersion of Israel among the nations. It referred to the abolishment of the law and the disbursement of Israel among the nations. This is what we see in Galatians 4 as being referred to as casting out the bondwoman and her son. That's the allegory of them being the law of Moses coming to its end and Israel being placed in dispersion, casting out this bondwoman and her son. This was necessary, for because the constitution which was delivered in Sinai to the Commonwealth of Israel was not tailored for the people and the state for the time when Christ should sit upon the throne of his father David and that the saints should possess the kingdom. Let's turn to Hebrews 8. Hebrews 8, verse 6. "But now hath he obtained a more excellent ministry, by how much also he is the mediator of a better covenant, which was established upon better promises. For if that first covenant had been faultless, then should no place have been sought for the second. For finding fault with them, he said, Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah." So we see, brethren, how even Paul refers to this covenant as having fault, because if it had been faultless, there would have been no need for a better covenant to be presented. So from the casting out of the bondwoman and her son, the verses in Hebrews 8, we conclude then that the constitution which was delivered in Sinai was therefore faulty. It was therefore necessary that it should give place to a better covenant, which shall be established on better promises. For this reason, the bondwoman was to be cast out in order to make room or a place for a more perfect arrangement of the commonwealth. Now, since the expulsion of Israel by the Romans, Jerusalem and her children are in the situation as was Hagar and her son, that is, wandering in the wilderness of Beersheba. They were then separated from Yahweh. That is, Israel was separated from Yahweh as they were cast out by the Romans, just as Hagar was separated from Abraham when she was cast out of the house. The record of Genesis 21:16 indicates that she went and sat her down over against him a good way off, as it were a bowshot. For he said, "Let me not see the death of the child." Let's compare this to what we read in Isaiah chapter 3. Let's turn there. Isaiah 3. Isaiah 3, just to set the context, look at verse 8. It says, "For Jerusalem stumbled," or "Jerusalem is ruined, and Judah is fallen, because their tongue and their doings are against Yahweh to provoke the eyes of his glory." And in verse 26 we read, "And her gates shall lament and mourn, and she being desolate shall sit upon the ground." So that's very interesting how we can compare that back to Genesis 21:16, where Hagar goes out as she has departed from the house of Abraham and she sits upon this ground, no longer being part of that house of Abraham. But brethren, we faithfully hold on to the words which Peter spoke to us when he says in Acts chapter 3, verse 20, where he tells us, "And he shall send Jesus Christ, which before was preached unto you, whom the heaven must receive until the times of restitution of all things, which God has spoken by the mouth of all his holy prophets since the world began." The key phrase there is, "whom the heaven must receive until the times of restitution of all things." That is, brethren, we look forward to the day when Jerusalem is to become a free woman, as Sarah was, and to take her stand in the midst of the earth, to be part of that city whose architect and builder is God. It will be at that time that Israel, or that she, will no longer remember the reproach of her widowhood. We are told, "For her maker will be her husband, and Yahweh of hosts his name, and her redeemer, the Holy One of Israel, the God of the whole earth, shall he be called." It'll be at that time, brethren, that she will be the metropolis of the entire earth, and her citizens, or her children, will be more numerous than those she rejoiced in under the law as a married wife. The period of her glory will have then arrived. The 12 tribes shall be a united nation, and they will be residing as a peaceful and a joyous inhabitants of the land. So again, now we have one more thing added to our chart. Now, while Hagar represents Jerusalem under the law, and Sarah, Jerusalem under the new constitution of the Hebrew Commonwealth, we now see that Ishmael represents to us Israel when they gloried in their fleshly descent from Abraham and when they boasted in the law. But Isaac represents to us those of Israel and the Gentiles who regard the flesh as that which profiteth nothing, and who are the sons of Abraham by belief in the promises which were made to him and his seed. That is, they now become spiritual Israel. Ishmael representing Israel after the flesh, Isaac representing then to us spiritual Israel, child of promise, born after the Spirit. So there we can say, Ishmael and Isaac represent two seeds or two classes of mankind who shall not be heirs together of the promise. And think about that, brethren. These two individuals could not live in the same house under Abraham in the time of their lives because they couldn't abide as heirs together. Can Israel after the flesh and spiritual Israel actually co-unite? Their very natures are so opposite that it would be impossible for them to work in agreement and complete the requirements marked out for those who are to inherit the promises. The Ishmaelite seed are wild men whose hands are against all who believe the truth. We are told that they are mockers. They are mockers. So when we think of scriptural types and anti-types, Ishmael mocking Isaac is the type. The antitype should be evident to all of us. Israel mocked Jesus. They spoke reproachfully unto him and even unto his brethren, who we know are one. So much so that they even put him to death. But brethren, we know that the kingdom to be established is a righteous dominion and requires righteous men for its administration. For it is written, "He that ruleth over men must be just, ruling in the fear of the Lord." It is impossible that the Ishmaelite seed can be heirs of this promise. All the honor, glory, and power of the state were already in their hands once before under the Mosaic Constitution. And yet how cruel and unjust were they in their position that they even put their Messiah, the anointed of God, to death. They persecuted those to whom he gave to become the power, they persecuted those to whom he gave power to become the sons of God. So as in the case of Ishmael and Isaac, he that was born after the flesh persecuted him that was born after the Spirit. Even so, says the apostle at his time, it is now. And may we add, brethren, it shall ever be, until the time of the restitution of the state, when the last shall be first, and yet beyond the reach of evil. You know, we've proposed here that Ishmael is a type of natural Israel. And it's not me proposing this. Actually, Brother Thomas wrote about it in Elpis Israel first. And then Brother Roberts also wrote about it. Brother J.J. Andrew wrote about it. But most of the time when we think of Ishmael, in our present day thinking, we're so quick in our thoughts because we're so ready to make an answer for what we believe in. especially when it pertains to prophetical matters, that when we think of Ishmael, we directly think of how he represents or he is a symbol of the Arab peoples. Yet scripturally, Paul here has defined for us in Galatians 4 the primary type to be gleaned from this man Ishmael. That is, Ishmael to us should first pop into our head as representing Israel after the flesh. But brethren, we cannot ignore the prophecies of old. Let's turn to Isaiah 60, verses 6 through 7. Read those verses. In Isaiah 60, we read, verse 6, "The multitude of camels shall cover your land, the dromedaries of Midian and Ephah. All those from Sheba shall come, they shall bring gold and incense, and they shall proclaim the praises of Yahweh. All the flocks of Kedar shall be gathered together to you. The rams of Naboth shall minister to you. They shall ascend with acceptance on my altar, and I will glorify the house of my glory." Here, brethren, we see the prophecy of the flocks of Kedar ascending with acceptance unto Yahweh's altar. This is the kingdom age, brethren. When we compare this back to Genesis 25:13, it becomes very evident what's being discussed. Let's go there real quick. Genesis 25:13. "These were the names of the sons of Ishmael by their names according to their generations. The firstborn of Ishmael, but then the second one as well, Kedar, Abdil, and Mibsam." Let's now look back at Genesis 16:12. So we saw the name Kedar there, referenced in Isaiah 60, also in Genesis 25. Then we go back to the promise regarding Ishmael. 16:12, "He shall be a wild man, and his hand shall be against every man, and every man's hand against him, and he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren." Now, if one examines the allegorical aspect of these promises, we find that scriptures foretell to us how natural Israel will dwell in the land of promise, in the presence or in submission to their brethren, the seed of Isaac. Kind of took it a different direction than you thought I'd say, right? Of course, we believe that the nations, the Ishmael nations, will exist in the kingdom age. They'll be surrounding the nation of Israel and their lands. But if we look at the allegorical aspect of this, really, it's teaching us that the natural seed of Israel will inherit the kingdom. They'll inherit that land. They will be the ones that will surround and live in the land around the promised seed. Just as Brother Scott brought to us yesterday and talked about who would get to go in certain aspects of the land, the temple, how the temple city was built. You know, there are certain areas that we can walk into, or those that were justified, the sons of Zadok, only allowed to go in certain areas that mortals were not. Think the same things being foretold to us here, brethren. These natural Israelites dwelling in the presence of their spiritual seed. And brethren, we pray that we will be amongst that spiritual seed. Galatians 4:28. Wow, I'm running out of time. I think I had much. Galatians 4:28. "Now we, brethren, as Isaac was, are the children of promise." only Yahweh had the right or the power to appoint the heir of all things. Abraham could not appoint him. Neither could this heir be self-appointed. As we noted earlier, Abraham wished that Ishmael might be the heir, or as he expressed it, "Oh, that Ishmael might live before thee." But God could not consent to this. He was to provide him a son whom should be called Isaac, as promised. And he says, "I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant, and with his seed after him." That's in Genesis 17:19. Now Isaac was not only born of promise, but what's so unique about Isaac is that he believed the promises. And the scriptures tell us about this. Hebrews 11, verse 20. "By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning the things to come." By faith, he blessed Jacob and Esau concerning the things to come. In Genesis 21:12, it is written, "And Isaac shall thy seed be called," that is, Christ should descend from him. But not only Christ, but all those who believe in these promises, and all those who put on Christ, all those shall then be considered in Isaac, and being thus the children of promise. And also, as we're told, they should then be considered as counted for the seed. We don't really have the time to look them all up, but you can read those references in Romans 9 and Galatians 4:28. The seed, then, is a phrase that must be understood in a twofold sense. This seed first refers to Christ, and secondly, the seed refers to all who are constitutionally in him. Isaac, we see, is representative of both. For Christ was in his loins, and all those who are in him must be constitutionally in Isaac as well. In order to understand the scriptural doctrine of the two seeds as presented in Galatians chapter 4, one must avoid the fatal mistake that denies that the seed of Abraham after the flesh will ever be restored to the land of Canaan. You know, this was out of Brother Thomas's Elpis Israel, and I think what he was trying to disprove was what we call this replacement theory, taking the promises and applying them somewhat to someone or some other peoples rather than the children of Israel. But to believe in such is in effect to deny the fulfillment of the vast proportion of the testimony of God. The seed of Ishmael and the seed of Isaac are distinguished terms that identify respectively the seed of the serpent and the seed of the woman. And we can make such conclusions from verses such as Romans chapter 9, verse 8. Where we read, "The children of the flesh are not the children of God, neither are they all Israel who are of Israel." It is upon this statement of truth that we build our... Well, it is not just upon this one statement of truth that we complete our full understanding. We have to ask ourselves as well, is there nothing more to be done with the children of the flesh than to just dispose of them, to let them go out into that wilderness as Hagar and her son was, and never to bring them back? To carry out the allegory, God is yet to make of the Ishmael seed a great nation. For though Ishmael was an outcast and a wanderer in the wilderness, God promised that he should be great and that he should dwell in the presence of his brethren. Genesis 17:20, I will make him a great nation. In Genesis 16:12, he shall dwell in the presence of his brethren. So the children of Abraham, according to the flesh, are the children of the kingdom, as well as the children of promise. Only these two classes of children can stand in a different relation to the government and glory of the commonwealth and to the dominion of the nations in the age to come. The Ishmael children were cast out of the government by the Romans, but the children in Isaac will shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their father when the kingdom is restored again in Israel. In the regeneration, when the Son of Man shall sit upon the throne of his glory, the children in Isaac will reign as sons, while the children of the flesh will be the king's servants or subjects. The sons of the prince are joint heirs with him, but the servants of the prince are only leaseholders for a certain number of years. They're mortal individuals. If natural Israel is not restored to Canaan, the spiritual Israel then, that is to say, the prince and his sons, would then inherit a kingdom without subjects to serve. So there is a necessity for this Ishmael-like seed, or you would say natural Israel, to be restored to the land in the kingdom age. There has to be someone for Christ and the saints to rule over. Now the children in Isaac become the children of the heavenly Jerusalem by believing the exceeding great and precious promises set forth in the manifold wisdom of God. They hope to see Canaan and Jerusalem under a new covenant, which will constitute them both heavenly. They are even now said to have come to Mount Zion and unto the city of the living God and to the heavenly Jerusalem in Hebrews 12:22. But at present, brethren, it is only by faith and hope. And just as the city and land will be made heavenly by the Lord from heaven at his return, right now, their glorious attributes are rooted in the truth which comes from above. Belief in this truth and obedience to its commands is how the children of the promise and Isaac stand related to the Jerusalem which is above, the mother of them all. That is why the apostle exhorts them, saying, if then ye be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ sitteth at the right hand of God. Set your affection on things above, not things on the earth. For ye are dead, that is, ye are dead to these earthly things, and your life is hid with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, shall appear, then shall ye also appear with him in glory. So, in conclusion, or in a summary, you might say, yes, Paul was correcting the Judaizers of his day regarding their desire to uphold the law of Moses. And he did address that problem of their day. But in so doing, he also reaffirmed to the believers of that day, our day as well, of the things regarding Yahweh's covenants of promise. By his review of the two children of Abraham, that being Ishmael and Isaac, the first man being born of the will of the flesh, whereas the second being a man born of promise. Always thinking back to the covenants, this covenant promised a seed, which we see first had application to Isaac, But then it really had application to Christ. But wait a minute. It has application to all those who are to be born as children of promise. To all those who are completely willing to adhere to Yahweh's commands and have the desire to overcome their flesh. So we see, brethren, this promised seed was not only pointing forward to Isaac and to Christ, but all those who would adopt the same attitudes and characteristics as both Isaac and Christ, believing in Yahweh's word and having the faith to apply it in their daily lives. This faith, we know, brethren, of course, is rooted or grounded in the other details of the covenants of promise, which pertain to such things as the land inheritance in Israel, the desire to be a king or a priest in Yahweh's kingdom, to rule with their Savior, their anointed, and most of all, the ability to escape this body of death, that we may be invested with that incorruptible nature which shall provide us life evermore. So, brethren, then, what is the lesson or application for us? Turn back to Galatians 4:28. It should be very vivid to us by now. Now we, brethren, as Isaac was, are the children of promise. But as then he that was born after the flesh persecuted him that was born after the Spirit, even so it is now. You know, daily, brethren, we strive against this flesh, sin in the flesh. It persecutes us daily. But we cannot allow our sin's flesh to overpower us. So, nevertheless, what saith the Scriptures? Cast out the bondwoman and her son, for the son of the bondwoman shall not be heir with the son of the free woman. So then, brethren, we are not children of the bondwoman, but of the free.